You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area's talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
All this week on KCBS, we've been taking a closer look at the state of the environment in the Bay Area, from extreme weather and rising sea levels to what people are doing to try and make the world around us better. But what about the state of animals in this ever-changing environment that we live in? Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. As part of Odyssey's One Day, One Thing, KCBS's Eric Thomas and Nikki Maduro took their mics to the San Francisco Zoo and spoke with Eric Grusman, Vice President of Wellness and Conservation at the zoo, for a conservation conversation.
You must be incredibly excited about the pandas.
Yes, I personally I am. My past zoo I worked at was National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and I had pandas there, and I remember vividly everyone asking two questions while they walked through the zoo: where are the bathrooms and where are the pandas? And so, yeah, so it'll be an exciting thing, and a lot of people probably want to see them, and it'll be a great thing to have here in San Francisco. And I want to thank Mayor Breed for making this happen.
Obviously, the other question that people are asking is, when are the pandas coming? And what's involved in bringing the pandas here and kind of the steps the zoo needs to take to welcome them here?
Well, with any animal, we do a lot of preparation with their exhibit. So, and every animal has different requirements. So we'll have to take those requirements that the pandas will need and be able to produce that in an exhibit. We not only just want to have the animals thrive here, we want to have them be able to show natural behaviors. And with that, we'll probably go through a process of trying to figure out what we can have them, what we can produce in their environment to have them show natural behaviors. Mm. So,
speaking of that, how does the climate of coastal California match up with their natural habitat?
Coastal California is, 53 all winter and 54 all summer.
Yep.
So, somebody actually asked me this the other day, and the environment here is not real. It doesn't get very, very hot, and it doesn't get very, very cold. And a lot of animals acclimate to wherever they are. And so I think it's really special here that we have something that, because we don't have those extremes, it's really easy for animals to make it here. We've had polar bears here before, and people say, well, why polar bears and they don't have ice? Well, they can stand the ice, but they really don't like the heat. Mm. And we have red pandas here who really like it cold, and they're able to handle the cold, but they really don't like it hot. And just being here at the zoo, we're able to display them year round, and our pandas go outside all the time. Interesting fact, Sacramento Zoo has red pandas as well, but they actually have to move their animals into air conditioning all summer long, and we don't have to do that. We have natural air conditioning. So I would imagine that the pandas, giant pandas, would have a similar, they're not high altitude or as high as red pandas, but they're in forests, so I would imagine that there's compared to their natural habitat.
How big of an environment do you guys need to create for pandas? And are any other animals going to have to be moved to create room for these pandas?
Good question. The first part of that is we have an oversight entity that oversees zoos in North America called the American Zoological Association. Mm-hmm. And they have standards for all this. every animal they've created standards for. I am kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to animals, but there's specifically people who deal with just giant pandas, and they know a lot about it. So there'll be standards. So they'll say they need this much, one animal need this much space, two animals need this much space, and it's all regulated by the American Zoological Association, and they produce these standards. So we'll know exactly what kind of space we need, and we can do something bigger, but there's a minimum size and a minimum requirements for what we need to produce for them. And they'll have like an inside space that will have to have certain things. And we can, and an outside space that we can do things. There might be something where the a panda, they don't do well on gravel. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that's just one thing. I'm just pulling it. And so we won't be able to have gravel in the enclosure. So something like that would be something that there are all these standards about what's going on. And then the food is probably the most important thing. Luckily, I think in San Francisco, and we've kind of looked at this a little bit, but they do eat bamboo. Panda, is, the meaning of the word panda is eater of bamboo. We do provide food for our giant, our red pandas here at the zoo. We'll probably have to go outside the zoo to find lot more bamboo. But they giant pandas are in the bear family, and specifically, so they don't eat just bamboo. They eat a lot of other things. So we can feed them apples, grapes. They're kind of an omnivore. And the red pandas are actually in a different family altogether, and they ate a lot more bamboos. So, but they're a lot smaller. So probably something like that.
So talk about the significance. There are a lot of zoos in America. You guys get pandas. That doesn't happen very often. Talk about the significance of that.
Well, we've had pandas here at the San Francisco Zoo prior. I think it's 1980. In the 1980s, we had giant pandas at the zoo. My understanding and my past in at National Zoo in D.C. was that they were a gift from China, and China does not like to let any of their animals out of the country, so they couldn't import them, or they weren't traded or anything like that. But I think President Nixon was the one who actually was able to foster that agreement, and we got giant pandas in the National Zoo, and they were the only place that had it. I think since then they've had some other agreements with China, and have gotten these animals in. Recently, I think all the pandas were returned to China, and that's probably why this happened. I know President Biden talked to President Xi when they were here for a meeting recently, and talked about bringing them back to the United States.
What does, you know, the popularity of bringing in animals like pandas do for the rest of the animals and the zoo, and just kind of bringing attention to this?
Well, obviously, there.
I mean, what's the most popular animal before the pandas get here, right? I mean, what's drawing people right now?
What's drawing people right now? Well, for me, it's the Komodo dragon, maybe. There but it's, we just recently introduced our lions together, so people are coming in to see that. Usually in the zoos, baby animals are kind of the draw with things. But that's an interesting thing. So with conservation, and as I delve into that, giant pandas are a big draw, and to bring people in, and people want to see them because there are very few to see outside of China, and so that'll draw a lot of people. But there's also a connection to the community, and we have a large aging community here, so it's something that's, I think, would be a big draw for that. But with conservation, what we try to do sometimes, if you save the largest animal or the most coolest animal, you save the whole ecosystem. So with that said, giant pandas require a large amount of space in the wild, and so we actually save all the snails and bugs and everything else, all the whole ecosystem, we save giant pandas. And there's called a flagship species. Mm-hmm. And so we can actually, maybe we use that analogy and say, yeah, they're gonna be our flagship species here to save all the rest of the animals at the zoo. I would imagine we get more people here. That money will be spread for everything, and we'll be able to increase the resources that we have for everything here at the zoo, not just the giant pandas.
So you were aware, obviously, of the media reports about conditions at the zoo, safety, maintenance, those things, a critical report. What's your response to that? What's the zoo's response to that?
Well, I think the zoo's... official zoo response would be that we have and have had oversight in the American Zoological Society, and we're accredited by that institution. So we've been inspected, and we were inspected 2 or 3 years ago. We have USDA comes and inspects us every year, and it's an unannounced inspection. So they actually come in unannounced and do an inspection. So we can't really prepare for that. So we have to actually have everything running very well all the time. And that AZA oversight is really, really a rigorous thing. And their standards go up every year. So every zoo across the country has to go through that accreditation. And I would say that's that aspect of the fact that we're inspected proves that we're up and running and doing what we need to do. If we do have issues here, and taking care of animals is a very difficult thing, and I would say that's why I enjoy one of the aspects why I enjoy my job is every day is a new day. Mm-hmm. There, you never know what's going to happen. So with that, when we have something or an issue comes up, we identify that and address that issue and try to rectify what happened. So I know there's things that have happened here in the past, but I've been in the zoological community for a long time, and it's not isolated to just us. We always try to increase our safety, and if as things come up, we try to address that. And other zoos do the same thing. And if other zoos have problems, they actually share with us what goes on with that.
Okay, let's talk more about, you know, the changing environment, not just obviously for human beings, but for animals. How do zoos and the San Francisco Zoo play a role in helping animals as their habitats and environment are changing all around the world?
Part of my job and what I would like to see all zoos and especially us move forward when we look at this is educating the public about what's going on and specifically what goes on with each animal. And so that people can understand, you have a hard time understanding what's going on if we don't educate people. So my goal and our goal here is to try to educate people about what's going on with each individual animal in different areas. And that brings up an interesting thing. So we've recently kind of switched our focus here at the zoo from, we do a really good job right now of enriching animals' lives, and we do we have a training program and an enrichment program, and we had a really big focus on trying to do better, make our animals that live here at the zoo a lot better. And as you go through the zoo, you'll see different things in the animal's environment, and that those enrichment items try to portray natural behaviors. But we're trying now to try to concentrate on bringing conservation to the forefront and educate people about certain things. And our first initiative is to try to identify our critically endangered animals that are our species that are here at the zoo, and identify them and tell people about them, because they are actually on the critical aspect of disappearing from the world forever. And we currently have 14 species here at the zoo that are critically endangered on the IUCN list. And that's an organization that actually looks at animal populations worldwide and assesses their issues. And for instance, they might look at penguins, and there might be a lot of penguins. There might be a million penguins, but they all nest on one beach, and one oil spill could kill 3/4 of the population in one day, if it's an accident like that happens. So they're not our penguins here, the Magellanic penguins, are not critically endangered, but they're, but some penguins are, and it's just that sort of thing is how they assess those populations. So one of our biggest group of animals that have an issue here are the animals in Madagascar. Mm-hmm. And Madagascar actually has eight zones that are totally different ecosystems. And all those eight zones are being impacted by human activity. And so we actually have 4 lemur species here at the zoo that are critically endangered, and we're concentrating on having a Madagascar area and try to tell people about what's going on in Madagascar and what they can do to possibly help out and just us having people understand that that's a problem and helps those animals out, I think. So the next time you try to do something, you might go, what's going on does this impact anything on Madagascar, or how does that help? And other programs, we have orangutans here, and they're critically endangered. And we have identified that we try to get people to actually do sustainable palm oil. So there's a lot of palm things. And people have heard about this, but we're trying to actually dive in and go, like, so the next time you go and buy palm oil, make sure it's a sustainable product. And so those sort of things, actually, you don't think that that would make a big change, but it actually makes a huge difference when you can change a product. You can change people who are growing palm oil to do sustainable action. It really helps out those animals.
In Depth will return after a moment.
So you've mentioned pollution is one threat to wildlife. Obviously, climate change. What are some of the other things threatening wildlife out there?
Oh, well, there's... this is...
How much time we got? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, do you have time? I think what's interesting, and that's what I would think is important about how we go, how the zoo is doing this, is each animal or each species has a different aspect that affects them. And for instance, we are currently helping repopulate or... helping endangered populations of frogs here that live in California. So we have mountain yellow-legged frogs, red-legged frogs, and there's a Sierra foothill yellow-legged frog. And specifically, the red-legged frogs are not doing well in the San Francisco Bay Area due to, actually, it was gold miners came, and actually they ate frogs. It was an easy thing to catch and eat. They ate so many frogs that they actually decimated the population. And then instead of, they actually brought a frog from the East Coast, a bullfrog, that was bigger because they had more food, move for food, and introduced them. And those frogs actually are an introduced species that affected these frogs. So that's an introduced species that was affecting the frogs. But actually in Yosemite Valley, they actually, it got to the point where 100 years ago, they totally disappeared from the Yosemite Valley. So the zoo has actually recently, in the past 4 years, bred and worked with partners, Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game, California Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and a Yosemite Conservancy. And we've partnered with them, and we actually head start those frogs, and we've reestablished populations in Yosemite Valley where they're actually thriving, and they've discovered that they actually are laying eggs this past year. So we've saved a species. We had a species that was extinct, not in the world, but extinct from a certain area in our backyard, and we've been able to reestablish those animals. And the zoos and this zoo have had a past history of doing that, trying to reintroduce animals. It's not the easiest thing in the world. This is kind of it's a cool story because we could be able to do it quickly, but frogs lay about 1,000 eggs, and out of those 1,000 eggs, if they're in the wild, to go from an egg to an adult, there's a huge mortality rate. Mm. About 5% of those eggs make it to adulthood. Oh, wow. So our Head Start program, which is kind of interesting, but to explain that is what we do is we take it from eggs to adults in captivity, and then we're able to produce about 95% live adults from eggs. So it's this thing where we, instead of having 5 adults make it in 100 eggs, we have 95 adults make it. And then we reintroduce those animals. So unfortunately, things like elephants or larger animals, they don't reproduce with thousands of animals, so it's harder to do the reintroduction process. So it's usually a couple of animals. The zoo was involved in helping reintroduce black and white ruffed lemurs into Madagascar, which is a critically endangered animal. And the zoo has a long history with partnering with Madagascar Fauna Group, which is an organization, and we were able to help out with that introduction process, but I think it was 3 or 4 animals. So, and then those animals have to thrive in the wild, and it takes a lot. There's a learning process for those animals to be able to go from a captive situation to a wild situation. So that reintroduction process is really extremely difficult. And so what I'm trying to do and what I've experienced is that if we can save it to begin with, mm-hmm. we don't have to go through that reintroduction process. When I first started working in the zoos a number of years ago, there was it was a thing about, hey, we can breed animals in captivity and reintroduce them, and that was the big thing. But things were disappearing, ecosystems were disappearing so quickly and so massively that we switched our kind of gears into trying to save things on the ground. And that's what we're doing, collaborative efforts with people on the ground and communities in around the world. And zoos are trying to help out NGOs and other aspects of trying to save the animals where they are and get the communities of where they are to save the animals that are in the backyard. And we're kind of trying to walk that walk and talk that talk with doing, the zoo helped with bald eagle issues that, so the in Southern California, DDT affected bald eagle eggs and they had thin shells. We had a program here that's now, we got to the point where we actually outdid ourselves, where we actually reintroduced 100 bald eagles back into the wild with a program we had here. And they went from endangered to no concern. So they delisted the eagle off the endangered species list because of efforts of captive bred things, and the zoo is an integral part of doing that. And we're doing the same thing with frogs, and other zoos do other things. Everyone kind of comes up with a different partnership or doing things, so it's not specific thing a specific animal. We can't do everything, but other zoos do different things, so it's kind of that sort of thing where it's like an opportunity presents itself. So we like to do I like to say we do things in our backyard and to support efforts in other places. And some of that is just educating people about what's going on. Like, you can help this out by helping Madagascar Fauna Group, or you can help out with Komodo dragons because they're specifically on one island, and help out with that community, or help that community with that issue of what's going on with there. And some of that has to do with ecotourism. Ecotourism is a really great way for communities to try to save their wildlife, so they actually employ and save their wildlife. I experienced that in Costa Rica once, where the community was overseeing the sea turtles laying eggs, and the whole community was like, I turned on a flashlight. I was mobbed by people like, turn off your flashlight, right. Don't do this. And I was like, but they were, the reason I was there was to see that, and I was paying money to go there, but that community thrived on the ability of those, if those sea turtles disappear, then they have nothing left. Yeah.
Some people might wonder, you know, obviously there's zoos and then there's kind of these safari places. What message, I guess, does the San Francisco Zoo have to people who think any sort of animal exhibit is good for the animals? Like, what's the difference that people should look out for? Because I'm sure there are some places where they're not taking care of the animals as well as they should be, and people might be mistaken when they go to places like that.
Well, I'm trying to think of an analogy to, there's good places and bad places.
Yeah.
I would say that what I mentioned about the American Zoological Association, the AZA, that they actually, if they accredited it, it's an accredited zoo, then they actually have those standards that we try to meet and they try to meet. And we try to even go beyond those standards at some point. But we did build a wellness department here at the zoo, and not every zoo has a wellness department, mm-hmm. but they try to model after us or other places and try to do that sort of thing. But that's, our wellness department actually is something that's a behavioral assessment of the animals that we try to do. So the veterinary staff does like the physical aspects of what might be going on with an animal that might be sick or old, and try to help them out. But we actually have a whole another division that actually does behavioral assessments of those animals. So if something's not doing well or doesn't appear to be doing well in their environment, we have a way of assessing that, mm-hmm. and trying to address that. And as a separate part of not just the animal keepers trying to do something. I would just say that's, I mean, as a basic line, I would say try to go to accredited institutions.
Well, I guess I'm asking, but, like, if you're looking in there, all the animals are kind of living in the same habitat type of thing. That's obviously not mirroring where they would be naturally.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess if I understand your question, that a lot of the animals we have that are in zoos now have been born in captivity.
Right.
So there's a really big difference between animals that are in the wild and animals that are in captivity. They're used to that, and that's what they know. So they brought up in that. So they actually
And they can thrive in that kind of environment.
Yeah, so that's what we're saying about the wellness department. Yeah. We try to get them to have certain things. I mean, a long time ago, it was like food and water, being able to provide just the base things of food and water. But we go way beyond that now. We do food, water. What are they doing during their day? If, for instance, parrots spend a large part of their day eating and looking for food. So instead of putting the food in a bowl these days, mm-hmm. we actually put it in items and try to hide it. So they spend, that's a natural behavior they're doing, is looking for food. And we try to produce that thing so they actually have to do, actually physically have to do that.
I think what she's asking, we don't see them much anymore, but you know, years ago, you used to be able to drive on the interstate and to be a roadside place where you could pet this animal or you could see the tiger or you could do whatever.
And those aren't good.
And obviously, you didn't know how they were caring for those animals or if they were caring for those animals.
Well, maybe part of that, my answer would be what you just said. You used to be able to see them everywhere, and now they're not everywhere. So, and I think people do go into places and look at the animals and say, oh, look, these don't look. Maybe this isn't a great place to go because these animals aren't doing well here.
That was just part one of this conservation conversation. You can hear more with KCBS's Eric Thomas and Nikki Maduro and Eric Kruseman and more on April 28th. You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. Just go to the podcast tab and look for KCBS In Depth. You can also hear In Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS Radio. Thanks for listening for KCBS and In Depth. I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.